Welcome to the Talking Heads podcast. Today, Evan and I will be talking to an old friend of mine and co-blogger, Colin Berkshire. Evan, where are you this week?
I am at home base in the bunker.
World headquarters?
World headquarters, social media command center, and an undefined location in New Hampshire. And I'm just hibernating for the winter.
Wait a minute, I thought you lived in Boston.
I cannot confirm or deny that I live in the Boston area.
Has it been really cold in New Hampshire?
Is the Pope Catholic?
Because it's been cold everywhere. You know, I was in Austin, Texas for the Avaya thing, and I thought it was going to be warm, but it was like, you know, below 50, you know, 45 or so, whatever.
Polar vortex, which is a made-up thing. Where did this come from all of a sudden? Did you ever hear of a polar vortex before about 2 years ago?
It's a line of long underwear, I thought.
Whatever it is, it's freaking cold. It's going to be something like 26 below as a high in Chicago, which is
26 just below?
Mind numbing and other parts numbing to imagine. So
yeah, that's my friend Sorrel Slaymaker. He sometimes talks about it's not cold unless the whiskey freezes, and I guess that's somewhere around 20 or 30 below zero. I'm not sure where that is. Where are you going to go to get warm?
A few places. So I'm off to Orlando, the home of Conferences USA for HIM, which is the largest healthcare IT show in the U.S. and the world.
So are you going by yourself or are you going with Irma?
I'll be going with Irma, and I'll be going with a whole slew of influencers to carry the social media banner at HIMS.
Excellent.
From there, I'm going to San Francisco for the Galaxy S10 launch. That should be exciting.
Is it really going to launch, you think?
It's going to be huge. Best phone ever. It's going to be fabulous. And then from there, I go on to Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. So that's a 3 for 3 of warm places. I'm pretty excited.
You hope that polar vortex is still moving that direction. You don't know. Well, I'm going to be over in Europe as well. I leave coming up here pretty soon for the Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise event in Monaco.
That sounds fun. I went to Monaco once. Loved it. Beautiful.
And then I was going to do a quick jaunt up to Lisbon. I've always wanted to go to Lisbon, and I'm going to be visiting Talkdesk while I'm there.
The life of an analyst is a brutal one. It's a brutal survival, but somehow you manage to trudge through it.
I do. It is a brutal life. It's sometimes hard to find the Marriott. Well, with that, we should get to our esteemed guest. You know Colin, don't you, Evan?
Only by reputation and by his written word. Finally, nice to put a name to the voice and chat on the podcast.
Yes, he does post quite a few interesting opinions on talkingpoints.com. And I'm pretty excited to have him on a podcast because a lot of people don't think he exists. They think he's a figment of my imagination, but he is not. He's real, and he's here. And so, through the magic of telecommunications, I am going to patch Colin in right now. Colin, are you there?
Oh, it's good here over in Thailand today.
You're not in Thailand today, are you?
I am. It's about 6:10 in the morning here.
So before we get into, you know, why you're in Thailand and all that stuff, let's talk just briefly about this mystery of Colin Berkshire. A lot of folks, as you know, as I've shared with you, don't think you really exist. Why won't you come out? Why won't you show yourself? Why won't you do tweets? Why won't you respond to comments? Why are you so mysterious?
I would say best answered two ways. The first is I express a lot of opinions which sometimes are not popular. And so I like to separate the opinions and my history from who I am today. And the second reason is, you know, I'm older. I have gray hair and my hair is thinning. And I'm not as into the social aspect and social media as a lot of other people are. I'm fairly old, fairly traditional. I like to have a moment to think about what I'm saying. Even being on this podcast is a bit awkward because I have to think on the fly rather than spend a day forming an opinion.
Well, Colin, I wish I had we had a president of the United States who was also a little less social and less comfortable sharing his opinions on the fly. But maybe we'll table that for another discussion.
Well, I have Asperger's also, so I'm fairly unfiltered. One of the things that I have learned is to surround myself with people who know how to reinterpret what I say and filter myself. And perhaps individuals such as you mentioned could serve themselves well by engaging in similar similar skill sets.
Okay. Well, that brings us to wireless, which I know is one of your favorite topics. And Evan, you're going to Mobile World Congress, aren't you, Evan?
I am. Fourth year in a row. And I think Colin will appreciate it. Mobile World Congress is the real wireless event on the calendar. I mean, it's the who's who of the wireless industry gets together, and it's kind of a nice show because it really makes news, you know, not fake news, not, you know, made up press releases, but actual real industry news. And of course, you know, lots on the table there.
So when you say real news, of course, you're talking about the real benefits of 5G. And I have a feeling Colin might have an opinion on that.
Oh, yeah. Colin is renowned for his skepticism on 5G. I'm more of a wait-and-see guy. Let's see the proof points. I mean, it's easy to be a skeptic. It's you know, harder to stand back and watch it evolve. But
I think 5G is exciting. I can't wait for it to happen. It just isn't what I think a lot of people believe it to be.
What do you elaborate there?
Well, you have to look at what 5G is. It's, first of all, it's a protocol, but second of all, it's also heavily associated with spectrum. And the 5G spectrum is what most people think about. And that spectrum is very high frequency. It travels very short distances and carries a lot of bandwidth. So if you look at the spectrum side of 5G, it is, let me be clear about this, it is not a cell phone product. It can't penetrate glass. It can't make it around a tree. What part of that sounds like a cell phone product? For delivery of internet on the last 100 feet, it's a great product.
So 5G is more about getting rid of the copper last mile than it is about improving cellular.
I'm not sure what else you would do with a spectrum that can't penetrate a pane of glass.
And you pointed out in one of your posts that this is really a problem because the 4G network is degrading in the U.S.
4G has been deployed differently in the U.S. than it has been deployed in most of the world and certainly Asia. Everywhere I go in Asia, from Hong Kong to China to here in Thailand, 4G is marvelous. You get 150 megabits. It's there. It's real. There's a bazillion people packed in very tight, and yet somehow everybody has a lot of bandwidth. That's not the case in a lot of the United States. I go to cities in Vietnam where there's no electricity, and yet there's cell phone service on 4G. So it's more of a deployment issue, I think, than a 4G technology problem.
But the point about it degrading in the U.S., I think you were talking about how, I forget the name of the post, it was you have less bars than you used to. And I know a lot of people chimed in on Twitter that they had you wouldn't know that, but they had agreed that they were seeing a degradation in quality.
Oh, well, that has nothing to do with 4G technology. That has to do with business decisions. Verizon decided that owning AOL was more important than owning their own towers. So they sold their towers. And AT&T did the same. T-Mobile did the same, to be fair about them. So when they sold off their towers to Crown Castle Corporation and others, they signed cancelable leaseback agreements. That meant that they took this fixed investment and turned it into a monthly expense. Now that they're busy selling unlimited data, they don't make any more money from you if you consume a lot of data. So what difference does it make if they cancel a few tower contracts here and there and here and there and here and there and another place and yet another place? So that's the math dynamic that I think is at play is if you look at the finances of Crown Castle and others, they're suffering from tower cancellations now. Who could have seen that coming?
Well, but 5G requires more towers. So how could they be canceling towers?
The towers that the big American carriers have are massive, massive $100,000 plus installations that are spaced 1 to 5 miles apart. That doesn't help 5G at all. With 5G, you need a tower every couple hundred feet. So it's the wrong kind of tower. What you need on 5G is a tower on every telephone pole. And that's why there's been some recent rulings out of the FCC that mandate local utilities to supply telephone pole space.
Well, do you believe that the carriers will move to a different spectrum on 5G eventually?
That gets into spectrum allocations. I did an article. I don't know if it's been published yet. I think so. Did an article about the spectrum that the various companies have purchased. And there, what's extremely interesting is T-Mobile's move, where T-Mobile has been very aggressive at purchasing 600 megahertz spectrum. 600 megahertz penetrates far and wide and can actually have towers that are some 30-mile radiuses. But what 5G comes into play on that is, rather than hopping from tower to tower, you can have overlays. So you can have a 30-mile circle around a tower, and then you can have a whole bunch of towers that have 1 to 5 mile radiuses, and your cell phone will go for the smallest, closest tower that gives an adequate signal. But if it doesn't get a good signal, it will back off to the lower frequencies. So that you get great coverage. So that means that you can get coverage down in the basement, you can get coverage up on the side of a mountain, and yet every time you're close to a traditional, say a 2 gigahertz tower, you'll hop onto that, freeing up these very, very large 600 megahertz towers. Does that make sense? The 5G protocol allows your phone not only to choose the closest tower, but allows you to choose the tower that's got the smallest radius that serves you.
So I think I'm keeping up with you here. But then if the spectrum can change and T-Mobile's doing it one way now, isn't it just safe to assume that Verizon and AT&T will change the spectrum when they build this thing out?
Verizon is selling off their 600 megahertz spectrum, and who's buying it? Oh, T-Mobile. So what's happening here is, T-Mobile is busy acquiring this useless, worthless 600 megahertz spectrum that is going to turn out to be the thing that makes the T-Mobile network better than all of the others. Today, 600 megahertz is pretty useless. But in 1 or 2 years, it's going to be great. And Verizon's selling it off left and right. And T-Mobile's buying it up. What you're going to end up with is T-Mobile owning a hoard of 600 megahertz and Sprint too. And by the way, Dish Network is not to be left out of this equation. There are four big companies that own spectrum. And Dish Network owns about the same amount of total spectrum quality stuff as T-Mobile or Sprint.
Yeah, you did a post about that. You think that T-Mobile and Dish will merge. You still thinking that way?
I don't know if they will, but if they can pull it off, if Ergen from Dish Network can do a deal with T-Mobile, T-Mobile walks away with a Cheshire cat grin. Dish owns an enormous amount of spectrum that they're simply not using and are getting in trouble for not using because they're just hoarding it. And that's why Dish has announced the largest Internet of Things network in the world. Is they're supposedly spending years and years designing this Internet of Things network that no one knows what it is. As far as I can tell, it's to connect one device in every major city to show the FCC they're using the spectrum. But I don't know where the market is for connected washing machines that isn't served by Wi-Fi.
So, Colin, what happens when Elon Musk's OneWeb gets in the game? Do you think they're going to have an opportunity to disrupt broadband wireless in the way that Musk is talking about blanketing the planet with 600 low Earth orbit satellites?
I think it's a good broad spectrum. How do I say this? It's a good way to provide coverage throughout all of the Earth. And it potentially solves the last mile problem. I don't know what the latency is. Whenever I hear satellite, the first thing that I look at, what's the latency? Because that has an enormous impact on the quality of the internet connection. We learned at AT&T in the 1980s that latency is everything. It is what allows you to have a reasonable phone call and allows you to transfer files at reasonable rates. It's more important than the bandwidth. So I want to see what the latency is on this network.
You mentioned AT&T. For our listeners, I think we should clarify that's the old Bell Labs you're talking about. Of course, you don't really have any fond memories of Bell Labs. It kind of as apparent in your post. How long were you at Bell Labs?
2.5 years. I was there from 79 up until 81. And that's when I got a phone call from my sponsor telling me it's time to change companies.
In that 2.5 years, did you work on anything interesting?
Well, the most interesting was a product called ACS. It was to have been the internet. The Bell system had the vision of the internet in the 1970s, and Billy Oliver understood that everything was going to need high-speed internet, and this needed to be deployed. The two basic problems that Bell had at that time was, first, we still believed in hub-and-spoke communications as being the end-all. So our view was that cable pair was going to go to central offices, which were then going to trunk traffic across the country. That is, not packet switched, circuit switched. That model turned out to be just completely wrong. The second difficulty that we had was the belief that we could actively switch packet traffic. And so all of the traffic within the switch was packetized before it was sent back into a space switching, that is basically circuit switched. And the processors at that time were just not fast enough to process packets one by one in software. You needed hardware. And so AT&T got, by the time they were done, about $1 billion into developing a system that never could be made to work.
That's funny. Dave Michaels sometimes claims he invented the internet, but I never took him seriously. So,
Well, I fixed the problems he's describing, actually,
oh, I
what
see.
Happened.
Okay.
But Colin, go ahead and explain a little bit for our listeners that the AT&T you're referring to is not the AT&T we know today.
Well, the AT&T we refer to today as wireless actually came from Macaw Cellular. It's also the AT&T that got broken up in 1983 that then shriveled and came close to being financially destitute that then Southwestern Bell picked up and did a reverse merger and called themselves AT&T. It's very confusing. The AT&T of today is the Macaw Cellular Network plus the AT&T brand merged into Bell South, Southwestern Bell, that whole area that took on the AT&T name. Does this make sense? It's complicated.
It does to me, but I wasn't, that's what I wanted.
So, Colin, tell us, where did we go wrong in our telecom history and our telecom economics? I mean, every other country in the world seems to have faster internet than us in the developed world. You know, what could we have done differently on the road we took and the various FCC decisions?
The problem that we've had for the last, well, since divestiture in 1983 is the same one that plagues us today. It's very simple, and it is, what do we mean by free marketplace? Do we mean a marketplace which is unregulated, or do we mean a marketplace which is a level playing field? A level playing field marketplace is inherently regulated, but the regulation is to level the playing field, to say that everybody must hook up to everybody, that everybody must operate on the same terms, that, if you will, there must be network equality or neutrality. So is a free marketplace going to be an unregulated one, or is it going to be a level playing field? And as long as we maintain it's an unregulated one, then power will have a tendency to consolidate, and that power will tend to be abused by companies like Comcast in monopoly service areas. The solution has been and continues to be moved to a free level playing field where everybody has to interconnect. Now, I'm fairly radical in this area. I'd say that by law, your cell phone call should have to roam onto any carrier's tower. And then whatever carrier provided you with the best tower service should get paid for that tower. And if it's a Verizon tower and you're an AT&T customer, there should be one unit transferred to AT&T. Basically, that's a level playing field. It encourages the build out of towers. It means that I could go into Montana and throw up a tower and start collecting customers and collecting money. And that's what we did on the old Bell system. It's what served this country very well for 100 years. And then all of a sudden, it became an unregulated market where Verizon can own spectrum and not use it. And that isn't good for this country. It's bad national policy.
And what you're describing is the fact or the reality in most countries, European countries that I know of.
Europe is very aggressive at leveling the playing field. In Asia, likewise, cell companies interchange a lot of traffic among themselves, and they're required to typically. Here in Thailand and in Hong Kong, there are mandates that you must use your spectrum and you must provide extensive coverage. You know, in the old Bell system, pre-1983, the country was divided into territories, service areas. And these territories or service areas were mandated by tariff, usually by each state. And there was an absolute requirement that a telephone company had to service every customer within that territory. If you were up on the side of a mountain, they had to run a phone pole to you. Because in exchange for being granted that territory, they had to serve everybody. That was the deal. So I think when we grant spectrum to Verizon, they should have a use or lose. They should have to have a tower to cover you on the side of the mountain, or if someone wants to build that tower, they should be allowed to.
Now, I got to call you out here a little bit on your selective memory, because you're holding up the old AT&T system as a model of competition and fairness. But, I mean, the bottom line is they got in trouble quite a few times with monopolistic behaviors.
This is somewhat of a misnomer. Yes, they did a couple of times, but everybody thinks that what they got in trouble in was the fact that they were a local monopoly. That is not why they were in trouble. They got in trouble because of their relationship with Western Electric. All the Department of Justice wanted in 1980 was to break Western Electric, loosened, if you will, in modern days, off from the Bell system. Justice never asked to break up the local monopolies.
What was the first consent decree? It was like the 1920s or something like that. And the issue was that they wouldn't let the local carriers connect to long lines. And so they went out of business, then they would come back in and buy that local carrier for pennies on the dollar and, of course, connected to long lines. And that was part of the monopolistic issue.
That was the Kingston commitment. Yes. And I view that as a level playing field type of a problem. And yes, there were some of those. The rule was that the Bell system had to interconnect with every telephone company. In fact, it's written into the Washington State Constitution that all telephone companies must interconnect. I took advantage of that through the 1980s and 1990s. I simply declared myself to be a telephone company. There were no rules as to how you did that or who could be, so I declared myself to be a phone company and ordered interconnect with the telephone company, and they had to provide it, and they did.
I vaguely remember you doing that. And I also remember kind of a related story. You have a waterfront, and you're not allowed to have a dock, and so you built a boat that looked like a dock?
And yes, and put a registration number on and even bought insurance.
And then you tied your boat to it.
That's right.
Okay.
Two hog-tied boats are not an abnormal thing. You know, it's done all the time.
So, Colin, I'm beginning to realize your true name might be Warren. Is it Warren of Berkshire Hathaway? Is that your true identity? Warren Buffett, maybe, of Berkshire Hathaway, I think?
No.
I think I'm beginning to put the pieces together here.
No, but the Colin Berkshire name, ask Dave Michaels sometime, does have an interesting history.
Okay, well, that was my guess. So I'll try again.
So just to clarify that, I want to clarify this on the record. It's in that post I mentioned earlier, but Colin Berkshire is not your real name. But everything, and I want you to verify this, Colin, everything that is posted under Colin Berkshire on Talking Points is indeed written by you and only you.
It's written only by me. I've never seen a Colin Berkshire posting that you put out that is not my words. It is my words, and it is from my life experience. They're not fake stories. They're not pseudo stories. They're what I saw and felt and tasted as I've lived through life here for 61 years.
One of my favorite posts of all time, actually, is the $5 tip jar. I think it was in Thailand, actually.
Oh, Cambodia. We were headed over from Thailand into Cambodia, needed to get a visa on arrival as you go across the border. And the visa room was just filled with backpackers, endlessly filled with backpackers, waiting for their visas. And they're all complaining that they'd been issued visas or applied for visas first thing in the morning. Well, the last bus out of there is at 4 o'clock, and they were all worried that they weren't going to get their visas by four, and their worries were well-founded. I was with my wife at the time. She knows more about how these things work, and she noticed a bottle with a bunch of coins in the bottom of it, and a cover on the bottle, and a slot that was too small to allow really anything to be put in. But it looked like a tip jar where you could put a couple of small coins. But there was a 100 baht bill sitting in this bottle at the top of the coins. And we both realized there's no way that bill could have been placed in the bottle by a customer. And that's when we realized that the purpose for the tip jar was to tell us what the appropriate bribe was. And so very quickly, we pulled out two 100 baht bills, about $3, put the bills in our passports, turned them in with our visa application paperwork, and before we could sit down, our name was already being called and our visas had been issued. And all of the stupid backpackers were there going, well, why do they get special service? And I'm thinking, because you wouldn't pay $3.
All right, so we can't wrap up this podcast without getting to one of your favorite topics, and I think our listeners would be upset if we didn't. I got to ask you, how you feeling about Apple these days?
Well, there's a loaded question. Well, the Lightning cable hasn't been the most exciting thing in my life. No, I'm hard-pressed to see how Apple is on my side, except for their privacy policies and their upgrade policies on software. What other thing does Apple do that's any good anymore?
Yet, as far as I can tell, everything you touch is an Apple device. How many Apple devices do you touch in a given, 24-hour period?
20. But my laptop is old. Remember, I bought a laptop that Apple misrepresented. I sued him and got my money back. So I'm on an 8-year-old laptop. The HomePod that I bought, its only job in life is to tell me what the weather forecast is for the day. I don't actually play music through it. I've switched over to Bose. I'm running on an iPhone 7. I haven't yet seen a reason to upgrade. I have money to spend with Apple. I'd love to spend money with Apple. So the fact that I'm touching a lot of devices, you've got to ask, how old are the devices? And what's not happening right now is Tim Cook is not picking my pocket. I have money in my pockets, but he's not going for it.
Well, that's because he's stolen twice as much from me. But in any case, Colin, you're a pretty thoughtful guy. What's your take on the new monopoly, the new Facebook, Google, Amazon monopoly that has taken over from what we used to have in with the old Bell companies? I mean, what are your thoughts on this monopolistic behavior and what's happening at Facebook with its abusive behaviors? I mean, any thoughts on how that can be either regulated or managed from a policy standpoint?
It's scary, and I'm not as close to Facebook because I don't do social media, but the recent announcement that Microsoft is switching over to using Chromium and the Chrome engine within its browser, almost concurrent with Google talking about how they're going to start disabling ad blockers, that scares me. That looks like there's been a secret handshake in a back room where Google said to Microsoft, you discontinue being in the browser business. You just use our code. We're going to disable all of the ad blockers out there. That sort of thing really scares me, that sort of consolidation and control. What I hear happening over on the Facebook side isn't much better. And all of these social networks seem to have similar problems. Here in Thailand, it's Line. Line is the network that has just a stranglehold on this marketplace. Americans have probably never heard of Line. Over in China, you're on WeChat. You go over to India and, why can't I think of the name of
it? WhatsApp, which is Facebook.
Yep. So, I don't know what the answer is here. It is a dereliction of duty, what's going on at the IETF right now, the lack of messaging standards and the whole email standard. The reason we have these messaging, instant messaging apps out there is because email has not evolved. Email should have had messaging added on to it, and it didn't. And heck, it doesn't even have security, end-to-end security added on. And so there's been this need for text messaging. I do 1,000 text messages a day. Maybe not that, but I certainly do a couple hundred. And there's no standard. So every one of these messaging services has their own proprietary standard and no reason to interconnect. That problem would not have existed if IETF had standardized text messaging and the features we know as text messaging today.
Well, I don't know if it's IETF, but I got to correct you. They did address this and solve it 10 years ago with RCS, and we're just about 5 more years away from being implemented.
Oh, Jan, very exciting, Jan.
All right. Well, thank you for coming out and joining us on this podcast. And with that, we look forward to reading more of your content. Thank you.
Thanks, Colin.
You want some information, some kind of conversation. Bye.